I'm very, very hopeful that this law, as a body of law, will make Alaska a safer place.
Amending criminal justice legislation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 4th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Airlines buys Virgin Airlines and possibly raises its coolness factor.
You know, Virgin, you feel like you're going to the club. Anytime I walk on a Virgin airplane, I kind of look like there should be a bouncer who's telling me I'm not allowed on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Senators have amended a bill that would overhaul Alaska's criminal justice system, taking steps that make it more difficult for those convicted of sex crimes from benefiting from the bill's provisions. Senate Bill 91 is aimed at reducing recidivism as well as the state's prison costs. It would divert people charged with nonviolent offenses into alternatives to jail. And it would create a re-entry program to improve prisoners' chances of success. But victims' rights advocates had raised concerns. The Senate Finance amended the bill to make it harder for sex offenders to benefit. Bill sponsor Senator John Coghill, a North Pole Republican, says he understood why the changes were made.
The Department of Law, the public defenders, the victims' advocates group have all had a huge say in it. The police, who have to hold people accountable in a very, very dangerous circumstance, the way we deal with drugs, all came to the table and I think hammered out a better way of doing it than we're doing it now. And so I'm very, very hopeful that this law, as a body of law, will make Alaska a safer place.
One amendment removed people found guilty of criminally negligent homicide from the group who would have their sentencing guidelines reduced. But the Finance Committee voted 5-2 to drop another amendment that would require drug tests to receive public assistance. Coghill says he believes the amendments increase the likelihood that the bill will become law by addressing the concerns of its critics. He says alternative programs to jail will prove their value over time.
Jail time is thought more highly of than some of the programs, and I think we just have to prove that. Time over time is going to show that programs can change some people's behavior, but it's also going to show that jail time is the way the public condemns certain issues. And I think that came very, very clear through the process.
The Finance Committee could vote to send the bill to the full Senate as soon as Wednesday. Late last month, the Senate Finance Committee introduced bills to cut back the Community Revenue Sharing Grant Program and up the amount schools and municipalities pay toward employees' pensions. The suite of four bills were pulled from a scheduled public hearing today, and late in the day, Senate Finance announced it had decided to hold off on changes to PERS, but consider the changes to TERS later this week. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
Four Senate bills introduced last week would dramatically increase local contributions to the teachers and public employees' retirement system, as well as halve the community revenue sharing program and eliminate a college scholarship program. That package of bills was pulled off the Senate Finance Committee schedule late Sunday, just ahead of an opportunity for public comment Monday afternoon. School districts, like Dillingham's, were preparing to paint a picture of the impact of the increased PERS and TERS contributions. Superintendent Danny Frazier says it would mean losing more teachers on top of the four positions the district has already cut in a tough budgeting process this spring.
We don't have a lot of places to get money except for personnel. So it's going to impact us greatly in that we could lose three teaching positions, and the district just doesn't have the money in reserve to pay these extra expenses.
The legislature is considering an anticipated $50 increase to the base student allocation. Frazier says that additional money would make up for less than a quarter of the increased PERS and TERS burden.
I'm sure that some of the Senate members realize there is going to be a lot of pushback on these bills, because while they are certainly a opposed to raising taxes. It's really strange that they're not opposed to us raising taxes.
That's Kathy Wasserman, executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, who's been working against the bills since they were rolled out last week.
These are not just small bills. These are not small amounts. These are huge amounts. And all of this is going to fall on municipalities. I can't imagine what they were thinking when they drafted these bills.
The bill's sponsors have said that some of the new costs to districts and municipalities would be offset by money that's currently being used for the Alaska Performance Scholarship and by local property tax increases on veterans and senior citizens. Hearings on the bills were canceled for Monday and Tuesday. A staffer for Senator Pete Kelly offered few details, but said the senators are waiting on actuarial data on PERS and TERS and might bring the bills back later this week. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Alaska Airlines announced this morning it's buying Virgin America in a deal worth $2.6 billion. It will turn Alaska into the fifth largest U.S. carrier. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, if any of the Virgin brand makes it onto Alaska's jets, passengers can expect a flashier ride.
Alaska CEO Brad Tilden says the deal will give Alaska Airlines valuable slots at New York airports and Reagan National in Washington, D.C. And Tilden said in a phone call with financial analysts, it will expand the airline's ability to serve Californians traveling east.
So it's really valuable real estate, and it gives us a shot at being your go-to airline if you live anywhere up and down the West Coast.
Tilden did not offer specifics about the impact on Alaska-based passengers who are already heavily dependent on the airline.
There will be the added benefit, of course, for people that are loyal to the frequent flyer program.
Brett Snyder writes about the airline industry in his blog, crankyflyer.com.
They'll have more options, be able to, do more through San Francisco, L.A., and head east and things like that. But I don't really expect to see a ton of changes for people that are in Alaska itself.
Snyder says whenever there's a merger, consumers want the airlines to explain the practical effects, like how the two airlines will merge their frequent flyer programs and whether the seat amenities will change.
And the reality is these guys don't know. So they know that the numbers make sense. They've created a story from their perspective where the combined networks are going to work and this is going to help them grow and achieve their goals. But the specifics, we just don't know. And so these will be unveiled over time.
The airlines expect to win regulatory approval this year and begin operating as one carrier at the start of 2018. It will be a meeting of two very different brand personas. Alaska's all traditional and buttoned up. Snyder says Virgin, with mood lighting and rock music, is far cooler.
You know, Virgin, you feel like you're going to the club. Anytime I walk on a Virgin airplane, I kind of look like there should be a bouncer who's telling me I'm not allowed on.
Virgin, for instance, transformed the mundane safety briefing into a slick dance video.
So won't you buckle your seatbelt, put it on tight, and keep your in that chair until we turn off that light.
As a brand, Alaska Airlines will prevail. But the Alaska CEO also hinted that the Virgin image may live on in some form. Virgin brand founder Richard Branson says the consolidation is sad, but as a minority shareholder, he was unable to stop it. The sale does not affect the British carrier Virgin Atlantic, which is separate. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Retired EPA ecologist Phil North resurfaced in the U.S. last month for deposition in a lawsuit filed by the Pebble Mine. Pebble alleges EPA broke Federal Advisory Committee Act rules when it developed the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment and says North was at the center of the effort. Since retiring, North and his family have been traveling the world. But whether Pebble found a silver bullet with EPA's once missing man remains to be seen. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Phil North spent his 23-year EPA career in Alaska, first in Anchorage, then in Soldotna. Over the years, he worked on a lot of mines, and in 2005, he says management put the proposed Pebble project on his desk. North started gathering information over the next year or two, and by 2007, he says in his mind, the verdict was in.
Alaska has the last really great rivers, and Bristol Bay is the best of those. So I came to the conclusion that this was a really important place. I also came to realize that the risks of copper sulfide mining, especially where the deposit was.
Remember, this is nearly a decade ago. Resistance to pebble was building slowly, but was nowhere nearly as researched and pronounced as it is today. North says the more he became aware of the situation, the more clear it seemed this was a logical place for EPA to intervene.
It made sense to me that EPA should use its authority to just go ahead and upfront restrict the discharge of dredged or fill material into those wetlands and streams. And, of course, EPA had that authority under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act.
He says that idea was received favorably by EPA managers, but North says he was a little disappointed by their choice of course. Rather than just issue preemptive 404C restrictions, which would be unprecedented, the idea of conducting an assessment of the watershed, public outreach, and everything else that has dominated the discourse for the past 6 years took shape. And here's where things get complicated, at least as far as Pebble and its team of lawyers allege. To shape its decisions, Pebble says the agency worked with or relied on people who were opposed to the mine, in some cases labeling them anti-mine activists. A federal judge has found enough credibility in those arguments to allow the case to proceed, and congressional oversight committees have investigated the same. Hundreds of pages of emails document the agency's effort, which eventually resulted in proposed preemptive 404C restrictions. North says while he thought EPA moved too slowly, he does support the agency's determination.
The purpose of the Clean Water Act is to protect and restore the physical, biological, and chemical integrity of the nation's waters. So I think that when we see something that needs to be protected, that it's our duty to go do that.
But EPA's 404C wastewater discharge restrictions are on hold while the lawsuit plays out in federal court. There's been much intrigue around North's involvement and whether or not, with the help of anti-mine activists, he steered the agency towards a predetermined outcome. North frequently used a personal email account for government work. He also guided the assessment's use of a hypothetical mine scenario, which is now met with much criticism. North has been the subject of a slew of news articles, court documents, and congressional hearings, none with his input, as he's been impossible to track down over the past 3 years.
Frankly, it's really annoying because it's been a lot of misinformation. And when you're retired, I think you just sort of want to blend into the background. And it's kind of prevented me from doing that to the degree that I would like. And the information's been generally wrong, so that makes it even worse.
Last week, Phil North was cooperative for some 10 hours of deposition in a Washington, D.C. law office. But he says he's not headed back to join his family in Indonesia just yet. Since he happened to be in town, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology subpoenaed him to appear for further questioning on April 14th. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a large-scale plan for Juneau to incorporate hydropower.
So we would spiderweb out downtown first, and then we're looking at the future. There's enough product or heat availability out of the Gastineau Channel to do Douglas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Today, the decision to base the F-35 fighter jet at Eielson Air Force Base was made official. The Air Force says two F-35 squadrons are expected to be assigned to the base 26 miles south of Fairbanks. Eielson already has an F-16 Fighting Falcon Aggressor Squadron. The F-35s are expected to arrive in 2020. Construction on base to prepare for the aircraft is expected to start in fiscal year 2017. A North Pole woman was killed in an avalanche near Summit Lake over the weekend. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the fatality comes as thousands of Alaskans head to the area for the Arctic Man event.
25-year-old Claire Sundgren of North Pole was snow machining in the Summit Lake area off the Richardson Highway Sunday when she was buried by a snowslide. Sarah Carter with the Alaska Avalanche Information Center says the slide was accidentally triggered by Sundgren's husband.
The man man was climbing a slope when he released and triggered an avalanche. His wife was lower on the slope, and the avalanche hit her and buried her nearly 6 feet.
Alaska State Troopers report that bystanders were able to locate and dig Sundgren out of the avalanche debris, and CPR was performed, but she could not be revived. Carter says the tragedy underscores the importance of interpreting terrain.
Estimating how far a slope will slide if it does, and having a safe zone out of harm's way, out in the flats or on high ground where that material will move down and away.
The fatal avalanche accident occurred just prior to the start of the annual Arctic Man Ski and Snow Go Classic at Summit Lake, an event that draws thousands to the mountains. Alaska Avalanche Center professionals are in the area posting daily forecasts, and Carter says conditions appear ripe for activity.
Natural avalanches are possible, especially with more wind loading, and human-triggered avalanches are likely because the new snow that has come in the last 3 weeks has been transported by the wind, and it is not bonded to the surfaces below.
Carter encourages snow machiners and other backcountry travelers in the Summit Lake area this week to check daily forecasts being posted on the Eastern Alaska Range Avalanche Center web and Facebook pages, noting the service will only be available during Arctic Man. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The state of Alaska has canceled standardized testing in schools this year. Upward of 70,000 students were scheduled to take Alaska Measures of Progress, or AMP, assessments across a five-week window, but the Department of Education called the whole thing off. The reason? Problems connecting to an online server in Kansas. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Students across Alaska logged online to take the AMP assessment on Tuesday. But testing was brought to an abrupt end when a construction worker accidentally severed a fiber optic cable at the University of Kansas, home of the state's testing vendor, the Achievement and Assessment Institute, or AAI. Dr. Susan McCauley, interim commissioner for Alaska's Department of Education, said the impacts of the broken cable were immediate.
We here at the department said, you know, what are the odds of this?
The vendor made repairs, but when testing resumed on Thursday, their system crashed several times. Imagine a test that flickers in and out of view as you're trying to take it, and you get a sense of what Alaska schools were dealing with last week. KCAW spoke with Dr. McCauley on Friday.
We now know that the system was patched in a manner that folks thought would work. We didn't know that until yesterday after things crashed. But the reality is that it doesn't have the bandwidth right now necessary to support students in Alaska and Kansas testing at the same time.
And McCauley added the test had other anomalies.
Kids doing just fine with question 12, 13, 14, 15, and all of a sudden question 17 is blank. We don't know why that is, and at this point our vendor doesn't know why that is.
Given these shortcomings, the Department of Education decided on Friday to cancel all computer-based tests, including the AMP tests, for the rest of the school year. McCauley said she made the decision out of a concern that the inconsistent testing environment rendered student results invalid.
So if this is of questionable validity at this point, if we don't believe the results are a true reflection of what students have learned, there is no reason to give the assessment.
The previous commissioner, Mike Hanley, announced in January the state would eliminate the test in Alaska, along with a five-year, $25 million contract with AAI at the end of this school year. McCauley estimates the state has paid under $10 million of that contract. Despite the costs, McCauley stands by the value of standardized testing for Alaska schools.
They contribute to a system of accountability for public schools in a way that I think is important, and also they should provide teachers, parents with information, valuable information about how students are doing.
And so the department will be issuing another request for proposals for an entirely new test system to be implemented in the spring of 2017. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The University of Alaska Anchorage women's basketball team fell 78-73 to Lubbock Christian in the NCAA Division II National Championship game in Indianapolis today. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
In the week leading up to the national title game, UAA head coach Ryan McCarthy said the pressure was on undefeated Lubbock Christian, and the Seawolves only needed to focus on playing their best game of the season. After the game, I spoke with Coach McCarthy, asking if his team was able to do just that.
We didn't play our best game. I think all the ladies would agree with me there. But we played a good game. We just didn't play a great game. And to win, you know, to beat a team that's number one in the country and undefeated, we needed to play a great game.
The Seawolves play a high-tempo game, moving the ball up the court quickly on offense and putting constant, overwhelming pressure on their opponents while on defense. UAA dominated in rebounds, snagging 47 to the much taller Lubbock Christian's 30. But it was not quite enough, as the Seawolves' 25 personal fouls netted Lubbock 19 points from the free throw line. Despite the loss, McCarthy says his team has plenty to be proud of. He says the team set 18 program records, won 38 games, setting an NCAA Division II record, and, of course, appearing in the program's first NCAA Division II national championship game.
And that's something that these ladies will never forget. They'll never forget this experience. They'll be able to tell their kids about this. And you know, right now, they're the best women's basketball team in the history of UAA. And that's really something to be proud of.
It will be a tough season to beat, but Coach McCarthy says the future is bright for the women's basketball program.
To build on this season is going to take a four-letter word, and that's work.
And those standards are set high, with the shoes of seven outgoing seniors to fill, including Anchorage's Kiana Engel and Galena's Jenna Buchanan. The Seawolves look to improve on their 38-3 record and avenge their 78-73 loss to Lubbock Christian in this season's national championship game. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Alaska House recently passed a bill that could make it easier for one hydro project to get going. If the Juneau hydropower plant gets built, the company wants to bring sustainable heat to some residents from an abundant source. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins explains.
In Drama, Norway, warmth is brought into its nearly 60,000 residents with this. And at NOAA's Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in Juneau, the building has kept a toasty 70 degrees the same way, using a seawater heat pump system. John Cooper is the facilities manager here, and he's proud that the building has been kept warm this way since 2011. With the price of fuel today, he thinks it would cost around $180,000 a year to heat the building.
With electricity, we're using about $36,000 a year to heat this facility.
The seawater used in the building's marine lab, the same water that holds starfish and sea cucumbers, gets cycled to the basement, and that's where the magic happens. Kind of like your refrigerator at home, that same technology is used here, but in reverse. The back of your fridge feels warm because that's heat that's been transferred away from the inside.
So if I stuck my hand in the gas new channel and to the touch it feels cold, actually, is it fair to say there's heat circulating in that water?
There absolutely is heat circulating in that water. I've got two pipes right here. One of those pipes is before the heat is extracted from it, and one of the pipes is after the heat is extracted from it, and you can feel a difference.
So imagine taking this idea, and like Norway and Iceland, duplicating it on a larger scale.
Well, the district heating has actually been a Juneau idea for the last 20 years, and we're just taking it to another level.
That's Duff Mitchell, the managing director of Juneau Hydropower. He claims the advancement of district heating is to heat
what LED lights are to lighting.
His plan is to build a hydro facility at Sweetheart Lake, south of Juneau, that will generate enough electricity for the project. Seawater would be pumped in from the Gastineau Channel. It would have to be around 37 degrees to work efficiently. From there, the heat would be extracted, and a closed-loop water system would circulate the warmth through pipes around the city. He says places like the Federal Building, Swimming Pool, and Capitol Complex would be heated with the technology. high-density areas work best.
So we would spider web out downtown first, and then we're looking at the future. There's enough product or heat availability out of the Gasnaw Channel to do Douglas.
Keith Comstock, the company's president, says 78% of people in Juneau use oil to heat their homes. Converting to district heating would be relatively simple.
Because basically they can leave their existing systems in place, and right now they basically burn oil, which then heats water, which then is distributed around. And so basically, we'll bring them a valve to their house where basically instead of getting hot water from their boiler, they can get hot water from the district heat system.
To be clear, the water itself won't come from the district heat system. The heat will. But you're probably wondering, who's going to pay for it and how much is it going to cost? Comstock says so far, private local funders have invested. It's about $125 million for the hydro project, $25 million for the district heating. HB 143, which recently passed the House, could help. If the entire legislature passes it, Juneau Hydropower may be eligible for up to $120 million in low-interest loans from a state-backed corporation. And for the remaining expense, Mitchell says they want to negotiate with the U.S. Department of Energy for more loans, not grants.
We've taken the approach that, it should be the old-fashioned American way. You come up with a good product. If you can borrow the money and make a business model, by golly, you should pay it back. And so, especially with the financial times our state has and with others, I think it would be imprudent for anyone to be asking for monies that would otherwise go to our schools or other things.
All right, so this is the boiler room?
This is the boiler room.
Back at the Ted Stevens Research Institute, John Cooper is showing me the two boilers that once burned 200 gallons of fuel a day. They're now backups. The room is used mostly for storage. And the space is pretty quiet.
This is the sound of progress. And I have a 10,000-gallon fuel tank out in the parking lot that stays full. It's got some stale fuel in it.
Although Cooper gets to enjoy the seawater heat pump system at work, Juneau Hydropower's plans don't extend to his home in the valley. The company plans to break ground this summer, and they would like to be delivering heat by 2018. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dave Benninger and Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Josh Edge in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.